This is the podcast for Thursday, March 10th, 2011. Theories of Reality. Our last class, the review. The first thing you'll get on the exam is these arguments for God's existence. And so make sure you know which argument is which. Because you don't want to be confusing the cosmological, the teleological, and the ontological arguments with one another. When you're trying to figure out, well, which one's the design argument, the cosmological, teleological, ontological, so you'll need to know the names of the arguments and what basically they're about, and then the objections to them, common objections, and objections of particular philosophers like Ganello or Hume or Dawkins. So let's just start out with which of the arguments for God's existence are a priori arguments? What is an a priori argument? It's the opposite of an a posteriori argument. Well, what are the three major arguments? Start it that way. Yeah, so cosmological, ontological, and no, that's the causal is part of the cosmological argument. Remember, cause, cosmological. So the cosmological argument can be broken down into two sub-arguments, the causal argument and the contingency argument. So we have the ontological argument we started with, the cosmological argument, which includes both the causal and contingency arguments, and then we had another argument right before the problem of evil. It's got a long name. So these are the things you'll have to know for the exam. The ontological, the cosmological, and the teleological. T-E-L-E-O. Teleo. It comes from the Greek word telos, which means end or result or purpose. And so the teleological argument is the argument about purpose or function or design. So the teleological argument is also known as the design argument. So when you see arguments about intelligent design theory and teaching intelligent design in public schools, that's all talking about the design argument. And that's William Paley and the Watch. So only one of these arguments is an a priori argument, and that's the ontological argument. The ontological argument is an a priori argument because it is a conceptual argument, which doesn't require you to do any observations. So an a priori argument is a deductive argument or an argument just based on ideas. With an a priori argument, you can just think about concepts and figure out what's true about the world. A lot of philosophers think you really can't do that. Although concepts might tell you what can't be possible. So if I bet you I had a round square in my pocket, if I did, you'd have to buy me dinner, and if I didn't, then I'd have to buy you dinner. That'd be you get a free dinner because I can't possibly have a round square in my pocket because there are no such things as round squares or a square circle, if you like, if that's better. I mean, you could think, well, round circle is like a round square is like a square with rounded edges. I say, no, it's completely round, it's completely circular. But if I just say a square circle, it's a perfect square and a perfect circle. Those are contradictory properties. Or if I say I have a picture of a four-sided triangle, that's a contradiction in terms. And so in an a priori argument, it has to do with what's logical, what's logically consistent, what's contradictory, and a deductive argument. So the sort of all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. So you know that if it's true that all men are mortal, that they can die, and if Socrates is a man, he's a human being, then it follows logically by those two things that when Socrates drinks a hemlock, or he's going to die, or there's got to be some way to kill him, that it's possible for him to die. Now, Socrates drinks the hemlock and says, okay, guys, let's go out and get some Chinese food. I'm starved, right? Then you think, okay, well, either he's not a man or it's not true that all men are mortal. And so deductive arguments are like that. So Anselm, I guess we start out with Descartes' version. So Descartes says, Think about the concept of God. God is a perfect being. What does it mean to be a perfect being? You have to possess all the properties that make you more perfect than not perfect. If there's a quality that would make you better, then you've got to have it. You have to have all great making qualities. Because if you're missing something, you're not really perfect. You have a flaw. So you can't lack anything which would make you perfect. If you have something missing from your nature that would make you better than you otherwise would be, you're not really a perfect being. And then Descartes says, existence is a perfection, right? Because it's better to exist than not exist. Therefore, God must exist in reality. And so Descartes says that you take it, the concept of God and existence are like the concept of a valley and a mountain. You can't have one without the other. And as soon as you realize the nature of God, or as I should say, Descartes would say, as if you think deeply enough about the concept of God, you'll see that his nature implies his existence, and that God couldn't possibly not exist. You might think you can imagine God not existing, but it's like saying you can imagine a square circle. It's not possible. According to Descartes. Then you have Anselm's version. Anselm's version is an indirect proof. This is still the ontological argument, but Anselm has a kind of roundabout way of going at it. So Descartes says, God is a perfect being, existence is a perfection, therefore God exists in reality. Anselm says, well, let's assume atheism is true. So what does a person mean when they say there is no God? Well, what they mean is that you think that God's all in your head, that it's just a concept in your mind. And yeah, that seems reasonable. But what is this concept of? The concept of God is of the greatest conceivable being. And so what is the atheist saying? The atheist is saying the greatest conceivable being, we abbreviate to GCB, the greatest conceivable being exists only in your mind. Anselm has this tortured Latin phrase, that than which none greater can be conceived. I like the way modern philosophers just call him the greatest conceivable being, the greatest being you can imagine. So the atheist is saying the greatest conceivable being only exists in your mind. Now think about that for a while. The greatest conceivable being exists only in your mind. If he exists only in your mind, he's not the greatest, is he? There, you can imagine a greater being, you are conceive of a greater being, which exists not only in your mind, but also in reality as well. I mean, just think about your imaginary God that you're thinking about, and now think about that being not just being in your head, but also being in reality as well, and not just being a concept. Well, the real God would obviously be greater than the imaginary God. So the imaginary God isn't really the greatest one you can imagine now, is he? So therefore, the greatest concealed being must exist, because atheism leads to a contradiction. You're saying the greatest conceivable being only exists in your mind, which is just to say the greatest conceivable being isn't the greatest conceivable being, which is like saying, this is my watch, which is not my watch, or something like that. It's just nonsense, right? You can't say the greatest conceivable being only exists in the mind. That's to say the greatest conceivable being isn't really the greatest conceivable being. Which again is a logical contradiction. It's not just something sort of crazy and absurd. It's a formal contradiction. It's a contradiction in terms. So if atheism leads to a contradiction, therefore the opposite, theism, must be true, because there's only two choices, right? Atheism, theism. God exists, God doesn't exist. And God qualified in a certain way. So either a being of that description exists or he doesn't. And since the supposition that he doesn't exist leads to a contradiction, the other possibility must be the truth. And let me stick with the script here and try not to go off on a tangent. Okay, objections. So taken in order, you have the objection from the monk Ganillo, who wrote on behalf of the fool. So Anselm starts his books, like both monologian and proslogian. He starts out saying, "The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. And, you know, and I shall prove that the fool truly is a fool." And actually, it's more like, "Oh Lord, now I shall prove that the fool really is a fool, because he believes a logical contradiction." Essentially, so as you may have noticed, you know, Anselm's theology is all in the form of a prayer addressed to God. And actually, one point about Anselm, which I think is actually on the test, which I may not have mentioned, is Anselm's view about the about philosophy. So Anselm says, you don't understand in order to believe. You believe first in order to understand. So Anselm's famous for saying, "I believe or have faith in order to understand." So in other words, you believe in God through faith first, and then you use your mind to realize that you have all sorts of good reasons for believing it. But you don't believe in God because you got a logical argument that proves God exists. You believe in God because you have faith. But then once you have faith, you realize that all those atheists are a bunch of idiots. So that's Anselm's view. No offense to any atheists out there. Atheists are sort of the last despised minority that can be beaten up on with impunity. According to Anselm, you shouldn't believe on the basis of philosophical arguments. Even though he thinks the arguments work, he says you should believe in God because you have religious faith and devotion, not because of the arguments. Although the arguments are good for the believer, in that once you become a believer, you realize that God is so great that you can't even logically conceive of his not existing. So he says, you believe in order to understand, you don't understand in order to believe. So anyway, Ganillon writes his book On Behalf of the Fool, where he's arguing, you know, the atheist case, even though Ganillon is a Christian monk just like Anselm is. But he says, this argument is a stupid argument. Yes, God exists, but this argument doesn't prove it. And so what he says is, you know, consider this a lost island. I have this island, and it's perfect in any way. It's a perfect island. You doubt my island exists? Ah, but you have to admit that the island still exists as a concept in your mind. So what you say is that the greatest conceivable being exists only in your mind, but not in reality. But if it's really the greatest conceivable island, then there is still a greater island, which exists not only in your mind, but also in reality. Hence, the greatest conceivable island exists, right? Along with the greatest conceivable paper cup, and the greatest conceivable watch, the greatest conceivable mouse, right? You could, the greatest conceivable whatever, right? And so, and his argument is that an argument of this type, which proves all sorts of crazy things, like that a perfect island exists, can't be a valid argument. Because an argument that can prove anything doesn't prove... an argument that can prove anything proves nothing. So, Anselm comes back and says, well, that's not really a valid objection, because I'm not talking about the greatest conceivable category of thing. I'm not saying that for every type of thing there is out there, you know, the clocks and... cups and turnips, and or even general categories like animals, there's a greatest conceivable animal, there's a greatest conceivable rock, or there's a greatest conceivable leaf, right? He says, what I'm saying is that there's a greatest conceivable existing thing. That's what I mean by greatest conceivable being. And obviously God is greater than any island. So what he says is, Ganillo, you didn't follow my logical form. You're trying to come up with an argument just like mine, which proves all sorts of ridiculous things, but your argument really isn't like mine. It's different. It doesn't follow it exactly. You're talking about kinds of beings. I'm talking about, of all the kinds of beings there are, there must be a greatest conceivable being. Because if he didn't exist, he wouldn't be the greatest. So that's Anselm's argument. Anselm's argument is one of those arguments that, you know, I don't know that anyone has ever came to believe in God based on the Anselm's ontological argument. And most people, even people that believe in God for other reasons, or even, you know, through faith without any rational reasons at all, still look at it as sort of a trick. Although there are people at University of Notre Dame, and there's logicians that well, even Bertrand Russell for 2 weeks. Bertrand Russell, one of the most famous philosophers of the 20th century, thought the ontological argument was sound. He talks in an autobiography about throwing a tin of pipe tobacco up in the air and saying to himself, "By Jove, the ontological argument is sound." And he believed in God for about 2 weeks, and he went back to being atheist when he read Kant's Critique of It. This is like he was still in college, so he hadn't read Kant's Critique of It. And then he said, "Oh, well, you know, I guess there isn't a God." And he went back to being an agnostic, I guess. Agnostic and atheist are kind of slippery terms, because at one time Russell said, "Well, I'm not really an atheist, and I'm agnostic." And then he described his agnosticism in this way: it's possible that there's a teapot orbiting the planet Mars, but it's not very likely. Belief in God's like that. So, you know, it's broadly logically possible that there's a God, according to Russell. It's just not a very likely possibility. So, you know, it seems that it's probably a philosophical quibble for Russell to call himself an atheist and or an agnostic and an un-atheist. Anyhow, so Anselm, since atheism leads to a contradiction, theism must be true, or to put it another way, God exists by definition. And both Anselm and Descartes would agree with that. And then Kant's criticism of the ontological argument is that existence isn't a property. And went round and round with Isaac on this one. He still wants to stump for existence being a property. But existence is a different sort of thing. You know, and I'm using thing in sort of the broadest, vaguest sense. It's a different kind of phenomena, or I'm not going to say property, but it's different than being green or brown or square or 50 years old. Or you think about all the properties a thing can have. Like this cup, you know, it's made of paper and it has water in it, and it's got the globe printed on it, and it's brown and white in color. And if I'm going to list the properties of the cup, and I'll say, "Oh yeah, it exists." The existence isn't a property like, you know, being filled with water or being made of recycled materials. Existence is something which applies to the cup and its properties together. A thing is composed of properties, and then there's the substance which hold on, which have that those properties. And we say a thing exists when it is instantiated in reality. We have a concept of Sherlock Holmes, right? Does Sherlock Holmes exist? And we got into this too. Well, Sherlock Holmes exists in people's minds, in the minds of readers everywhere. But he doesn't really exist, right? He exists in some sort of funny way that fictional characters might be thought to exist. We could call it, actually there's a philosopher that called it subsisting, which is sort of a kind of a pseudo half-existence. But even though people like go to 221 Baker Street in England to see the famous residence of Sherlock Holmes and don't realize that he wasn't a real detective, that he was a fictional character, you know, there is no Sherlock Holmes. What would it mean if he was real? It would mean that there was a person that fits the description of Sherlock Holmes. But you wouldn't say, "Well, Sherlock Holmes would be a really great detective if he only existed." I mean, you might say that sort of casually, but it's not like his existing would be, and if he wasn't hooked on cocaine or, you know, whatever, or heroin, I guess. No, I think it was cocaine. It was cocaine. Yeah.
Not to get off on a tangent, but real quick. Talking about the existence of God is a little different because it wouldn't necessarily mean that you could throw a rock at God. You know, like God has a physical existence that you can shake hands. So any like analogy you're making about existence is going to imply physical form, which doesn't necessarily pertain.
Okay, I am used physical examples, but I mean you could have other examples like love exist or something, or do numbers exist, and those are kind of difficult questions. But it seems that you can have a definitive answer to that either there is a being who's sort of the creator of the world and is all knowing and morally good and all the qualities that people attribute to God, or at least the sort of westernized version of it, the sort of God of the philosophers, or there isn't such a being. Whereas, I mean, numbers and fictional characters are these things that sort of aren't really, they're not metaphysical beings. So even though God is supposed to be an immaterial being, he's still an existing thing. Numbers exist, I mean, in a way, as concepts. So, they're more. I would say they're more like you can ask like whether a straight line exists or whether triangles exist or something like that. Whereas you have physical instantiations, but then there's the concept of the triangle, and so it gets a little muddy there. But I take your point, but I still think that even though God's immaterial, he's still an existing thing. So. So the ontological argument, Kant says, is fallacious because it treats existence like a property, and existence isn't a property. Also, it treats existence as coming in degrees, which is a vestige of Plato's philosophy. And most philosophers think that either something exists or it doesn't. You don't have something that kind of sort of exists. So that's a problem. Another problem is that concepts like great and perfect are somewhat ambiguous and sometimes just seem to deal with what people value. What's the greatest conceivable disease or something? You think about, like, what is it? Would God be greater if he was morally good than if he was morally evil? Or would God be greater if he, had, you can think of some property, like, what greatness. Think about what is the planet Jupiter greater than the invention of the alarm clock, or is the planet Jupiter greater than a computer? Well, I mean, it's apples and oranges, right? What do you mean by greater than? But Descartes and Anton have this idea that there's this kind of chain of being, and you can kind of see, okay, this thing's greater than this thing, and this thing's greater than this thing, and they think they can categorize things and grade them as far as greatness or perfection goes. Is a planet Jupiter, or is it more perfect than, a fig leaf, right? Or, it seems not to make sense to ask those questions. So the vagueness in the terms greatness or perfection, and the somewhat subjective nature when you talk about whether something would be more perfect or not. A cosmological argument. Also, you should know there's the modal version of the ontological argument. Modal. See if I get that on there. Norman Malcolm. He's mentioned in the text in bold. So Norman Malcolm says that if God's existence is possible, it's actual. And this is from modal logic. If God is supposed to be a necessary being, if a necessary being exists in one world, he exists in all worlds. So if God's existence is possible, then he has to actually exist in some world. Actually, he has to exist in all worlds. And this would be true as a matter of logic. But then an objection to that is, well, maybe God's existence isn't possible. And so one of the ways to attack the ontological argument is to attack the coherence of theism, to attack the concept of God and say, well, what does it mean to be omnipotent? You know, could God create a rock so heavy he couldn't lift it? If so, then it seems either way he couldn't do it. If he can't create a rock so heavy he can't lift it, then there's something he can't do, namely create the rock in the first place. If he can create the rock, then there's something he can't do, namely lift the rock once he's created it. So either way, there's something God can't do. Think about like free will, right? If God has free will, then God can do evil. But God's supposed to be essentially morally good, such that he can't do evil. So again, it seems that hard to have it both ways. Or if you believe in free will, it seems that if God infallibly knows what you'll do tomorrow, then you can't do other than what God knows you'll do, and therefore you don't have free will. You just think you do. Or the problem of evil we talked about too might be a problem with the sort of things that are obvious or self-evident, like there's evil in the world. Well, if God is good, he wants to prevent evil. If God is omnipotent, he's able to prevent evil. But it seems like there's evil. So how can there be evil? And then if he's willing but he's unable to prevent it, then it seems like he's impotent, right? If he's able but not willing, then he's malevolent. Hume uses the word incompetent. So God ends up being either incompetent or malevolent. But God's supposed to be good. But if God's incompetent and malevolent, he's not really God, right? Because God is, by definition, a being who is omnipotent and beneficent or morally good in a maximal way. Okay, so attacking the concept of God basically is arguing that God doesn't really even exist in your mind. It seems like he does. He's an incoherent concept. He's like that round... pardon me. He's like that square circle. Okay, that's all for the ontological argument. I spent a little longer on that because students seem to have trouble with it. And we actually talked a lot about it in class. One last thing on the ontological argument. The ontological argument does not say that whatever you can imagine must exist. If you think that's true, you haven't understood the argument. What it says is that the greatest conceivable being must exist. So just to be clear about that, that's a common thing students say, and that is incorrect. That it's not saying the greatest conceivable type of thing of every type of thing has to exist. Only the greatest existing thing imaginable has to exist. Okay. Let's see. Cosmological argument. So the cosmological and the teleological argument, the other two arguments, those arguments are a posteriori arguments. They're arguments from experience. They're based on sensory observations or empirical data. And so the cosmological argument, which we get from Thomas Aquinas, comes from Aquinas' five ways of proving God's existence. The first three of those ways are the cosmological argument. Those first three ways, the argument from motion, the argument from efficient cause, and the argument from possibility and necessity, those three are the cosmological argument. So the first three of Aquinas' three ways of the cosmological argument. The first two are what are known as the causal argument. So the cosmological argument is the first three of Aquinas' five ways. The first two of those first three of the five ways, the argument from motion and the argument from cause, are both called the causal argument. So motion and cause go together because most philosophers see motion as a type of causation. So you have the argument from motion, the argument from cause, both both known as the causal argument. I should get a, feel like I should be writing this on the board. I did write this on the board earlier. It's been too long. I just don't have a pen that works anymore. It'll dry out on me. Oh, wait.
I have one here.
Uh-huh. I think this one doesn't work well either.
So, lists are always hard to do just without writing down motion.
It's called efficient cause. It's just
efficient cause is a certain kind of cause, which is what we mean by cause and effect. So this is Aquinas' five ways, and this is basically you get the teleological argument and the ontological. These are the version of the ontological and teleological arguments. But what I focus on with Aquinas is these, and so the causal argument says, well, how did the universe get here if God didn't make it? The universe cannot explain itself. The universe had to come from somewhere. So either there's an infinite regress of causes going back in time to infinity, or there was a first cause which got everything started. Then he goes through this sort of chain of reasoning. You know, the universe can't create itself because in order for a thing to create itself, it would have to exist before it existed, and that doesn't make any sense. Because if it already existed, why would it need to create itself? Because it would already exist. So that makes no sense. So a thing can't create itself, and so it has to come from somewhere, and so the question is, where does it come from? And he says that, you know, because you'll get something from nothing. So he argues that you have these two choices, the infinite regress of causes, one thing was caused by another thing, which was caused by another thing, just going back to infinity, or there's a first cause, you know, in the distant past, which started the chain of creation, which led to all the things that exist today. Now, he argues that infinite regress is impossible. An infinite regress of causes is impossible. Therefore, there has to be a first cause, and everyone understands that the creator of the universe, the first cause to be God.
And so that's the causal argument. Now there's some criticisms of the causal argument. One is that, you know, why assume the first cause is God? Why not some weird quantum physics thing, you know, that we don't really understand? Which has no consciousness, it doesn't love you, it's not like a heavenly father, you know, it didn't send its son to die for your sins, right? It's just, you know, some weird kind of, you know, thing with a bunch of like energy bolts coming out of it, and it's like a fundamental particle of the universe, you know, something you'd see in a sci-fi movie. Well, why not that? Why do you have to, and why this sort of Judeo-Christian God? Why just one God? Why not like a committee of gods? Why not like, you know, like the Mount Olympus where you have a whole bunch of different gods? So he's making a lot of assumptions about, first, that it's a conscious being. Second, that it has a sort of qualities of, you know, emotions and love and care for human beings. And then also there's just one of them. And also there's this, why assume that he's still around? Maybe God died. You know, he created the world a long time ago, and then his time was up, and he passed away. So there's all now. You know, there might be some problems with that supposition, but it's difficult to prove that couldn't be the case. That might just be another case of the infinite regress of causes. But in any event, there's a lot of unanswered questions, And so he really hasn't proved, even if he's proved the first cause, he hasn't proved that God exists. And then because the first cause could be a number of different things, including many gods or some physical phenomena. It commits the composition fallacy. The composition fallacy says that if something's true of the parts, it has to be true of the whole. Every student in this class has a brain, therefore this class has its own brain. There's a division fallacy too. So I could say, well, my brain is conscious, therefore every neuron in my body is conscious. But it turns out that's not true. You have a neuron in isolation. It's just a little switch. There's not a lot going on there. You put a bunch together, you get consciousness. You just got one little neuron. It's not going to do anything by itself. Even if you like jump a spark across it, it's not going to say, "Ooh, a spark!" You know, I like when sparks jump across my synapse. It's a collection of neurons. So you can't say just because something's true of the parts, it's true of the whole. Even though the monthly payments on my student loan may be low, it doesn't follow that the total amount of my student loan is low. Right? So it might be, for most people, it's this huge amount of money. They're paying a little bit each month. So the property of smallness does not apply to the whole. It only applies to the parts. And you can't say, oh, it's true of the parts. It has to be true of the whole. And that's what people try to do with the cosmological argument. They say every event has a cause. They're talking about every event in the universe. Therefore, the universe itself, the collection of all things and events, must have a cause. And that's the composition fallacy, saying everything in the universe has a cause, the universe has a cause. You're going for the parts of the whole, and saying that if it's true of the parts, it has to be true of the whole. And that seems to be a logical fallacy. And then you should know all this physics stuff, which has bearing on the causal argument. So, the universe is expanding at a rapid rate. We can see through the redshift of galaxies that every galaxy is moving away from every other galaxy at a fantastic speed that we can measure. It's called the Doppler effect, and so we can extrapolate back to a time when everything existed as a singularity, where all the matter in the universe was in this little compact space, smaller than an atom. And suddenly, about 13, 14 billion years ago, it suddenly began to expand. Nobody knows why. Some people sort of have some guesses, but then the question is, why did the Big Bang, go bang? And the theists will say, God did it. And then the atheists will say, no, it's some weird physics thing, or nobody knows. And so the physics can only show you that this universe had a beginning, and that it's going to have an end. And we're pretty sure what the end will be, absent divine intervention. And that's that the universe is going to sort of peter out. It's going to die not with a bang, but with a whimper. Because there's not enough mass for the universe to close in on itself. It's just going to keep on going and going and going, running out of energy. The stars are going to go dark one dot by one and blip out. They're going to turn to red dwarfs. They're going to cool. The stars are all going to cool. Pretty soon, it's going to be cold and dark. And even the energy which holds atoms together is going to break apart. And everything is just going to turn in sort of floating goo. floating particles, all falling apart with no usable energy. And so that's called the heat death of the universe. I like calling it the big chill, in contrast to the big crunch, which is what would happen if there were enough stuff in the universe to cause gravity to overcome the momentum of the expanding universe. Then it would all implode on itself and get back to a little singularity, like a cosmic trash compactor.
You know, neither of these seem very appealing to me, but that's sort of the way it goes. You know, Chronics is only going to take you, you know, a few billion years. We got 100 billion years or something like that until the heat death of the universe. There are certain stages where you get, where things kind of get more and more hairy, to where you're running out of time. But who knows what human beings could do in, 100 billion years. Maybe if there are multiple universes, they might find a way to get to another universe or change, control time or space-time. Anyway, so interesting to think about. There's actually a really interesting Isaac Asimov story about the death of the universe that has religious connotations, whose name escaped me, but I'll post it in the forum. Okay, so that's the Big Crunch, the Big Chill, the Big Bang.
Was that called the last question?
Yeah, the last. Okay, yeah, I get some sci-fi buffs here. It's a good story, a nice twist ending.
That's a great twist.
Yeah. Even though Asimov was a damn atheist, but he likes, you know, he's a fiction writer, so God figured he's written some other stuff with some sort of interesting takes on anyway, let's see, although he also wrote a guide to the Bible, tried to explain away the miracles as, you know, scientific phenomena, which was misunderstood. Okay, I think that's all for the cosmological argument. Any questions or comments about that?
I think that if there is a creator, and that implies that you can get something from nothing, which is a concept that you try and steal from that.
Getting something from nothing.
You know, get existence out of the voidness.
That'd be a neat trick, creating ex nihilo. Okay, so the second part of the causal argument is the contingency argument. The second part of the cosmological argument, I'll make sure I'm precise here, the second part of the cosmological argument is the contingency argument. The first part is the causal argument, which we've been talking about. The second part is the contingency argument. The contingency argument says that the universe isn't the sort of thing that could have just always been here. So sometimes you'll have the person that doesn't believe in God say, well, maybe the universe has just always been around here. But you can see the universe is winding down. The second law of thermodynamics says that the universe is winding down like a clock. And you can see that it's wound down, I don't know, maybe a third of the way. And you can see back at the Big Bang, the point where it was all wound up. And you can also extrapolate what's going to happen if things continue as they do, and it's going to wind all the way down at the heat death of the universe. And so it shows you the universe isn't the sort of thing that could be eternal. Now, Sagan's oscillating universe theory requires there to be more stuff in the universe than there isn't. So the Big Crunch isn't likely to happen. And Sagan doesn't really explain how the slingshot effect is supposed to happen either. Once you get to the Big Crunch, it's hard to see how that's going to create another Big Bang. There's no physical theory that supports that. It's just sort of a wild hypothesis. But this idea of that the universe isn't the sort of thing that could exist on its own is something that Aquinas picks up. And he says, look, if you look out at the world, they fall apart. You have entropy. And you know, the second law of thermodynamics says that all things tend towards minimum energy, minimum usable energy, and maximum entropy, disorder, or chaos. In a closed system, assuming we're in a closed system. And so the contingency argument is really about that. Now, one argument against the contingency argument is that we have this other law called the conservation of mass and energy that says that mass and energy is neither created nor destroyed. It's always constant. And it seems that as long as, in Aquinas' version, as long as the number of things created is equal to the number of things being destroyed, there's always going to be the same amount of stuff in the world.
So if you have, you know, you think about population, right? So people die, mountains are laid low, streams dry up. But, you know, new streams form and new mountains form and new human beings are born. Like for every person that dies, a baby or two is born, you're always going to have people. And so this sort of coming into being and passing away argument doesn't seem to work. And the modern version of the universe is maybe a little more plausible. So this idea that the universe isn't the sort of thing that could be eternal might work. But then you have people that say, well, maybe there are multiple universes. And so that's not airtight either, although I think it's better. So the contingency argument suggests that given infinite time, a universe of dependent temporary things would eventually reach a point where nothing existed. If you have a universe of temporary contingent beings, they would eventually pass into nothingness, just because nothing lasts forever. Again, this is a composition fallacy, right? If you say nothing left lasts forever, therefore, given infinite time, eventually there would be nothing. That's not true, because even though for every individual item, there was a time where it didn't exist, there's a time when it exists, and then there's another time where it doesn't exist again, that's not necessarily true of the collection of all things existing. It might be that there always were things existing, and that although individual things come into being and pass away, the collection of things is eternal. Okay, design argument. So the design argument is William Paley, and Paley says the universe is like a watch. You find a watch out in the middle of a heath, which is sort of like a swampy meadow, I guess, the Dellows in Scotland. And he says, if you find a watch and it's got, you know, a dial, you can see it's used to tell time. It's got an inscription on it. It shows fine workmanship. You don't think that random naturalistic processes created it. You see its order, complexity, and purpose. And you know that every time you find order, complexity, and purpose, there is a designing mind at work. So now think about, compare this pocket watch, as great as it is, to a human being, to even to like a little frog, to the human eye, or to any of the wonders of nature, or to the starry heavens above. Obviously, those things are much more complex than any pocket watch. Therefore, there must be a designing mind of infinitely greater intelligence than human beings. And so that's the ergo God. Now, a couple of objections to this. David Hume has some objections. And one of the things Hume says is that, well, what if I say the universe is like a vegetable? Where do vegetables come from? They come from seeds. Well, maybe you had like a universe pollinate another universe and it dropped a seed off, and that seed grew into a third universe. So you can have like we see flowers, they drop seeds. Where does flowers come from? They come from other flowers. Well, maybe universes are like that, and there's just always been universes, and they're produced by cosmic seeds. What about animal reproduction? You know, where do animals come from? You know, baby animals come from mommy and daddy animals. Well, maybe you have like baby universes. Mommy and daddy universe, you know, get together and create a baby universe. A supporter of Paley might say, well, that's absurd. And he would say, well, what do you think about, like, is God sitting at his cosmic workbench, you know, with his cosmic hammer and his cosmic eye loop, you know, it's just a metaphor. Well, why can't you have a metaphor? There's some interaction between two universes that produces a third, right? It's just a description. And these are processes we're familiar with, which don't require design. As a matter of fact, you know, I'm sure there's someone in this room who was produced with no planning whatsoever, who was a glorious accident. Well, maybe the universe is a glorious accident. Maybe it's just that universes do certain things that follow the laws of nature, and there's no planning or thought to it. It's just these physical processes. And Hume says, when you think about it, this biological reproduction is what produced you. And so if you think about, well, where does where does the order you find in human mind come from? It comes from animal reproduction. So if you're going to pick something as the fundamental spring and principle of the universe, you should go with sex, not the mind. Okay, so that's Hume's two arguments, his animal and his plant-animal analogies. And then there's evolution. And evolution explains how you could get order, complexity, and purpose without a mind. And Richard Dawkins calls evolution the blind watchmaker. So he's just like Paley's watchmaker, except for he doesn't know what he's doing. And he's not even a he. Yeah, the blind watchmaker is a metaphor for evolution, which is just this mechanical process of energy and pushes and pulls and solar radiation and cosmic rays and random mutation and then natural selection, and that those organisms lucky enough to have good mutations, which are random. So most of the mutations will be bad, some will be good. Those get passed on to offspring because animals with an advantage will produce more offspring, and those offspring will inherit the genes which make them adaptive. And these things build on each other. And over millions and millions and billions of years, you end up with all the diversity of life that we find today. And so you should know, too, that this doesn't mean that you can't believe in God and evolution. It just means that if evolution is true, then virtually all, I don't want to say consensus makes something true, but it's the sort of considered to be subtle science. Like, you know, not like the global warming nonsense, but like more like Newton's laws. Yeah, evolution is firmly ensconced in the scientific community. It's not regarded as speculative by anyone, except for a person with a previous commitment of some kind to a religious ideal. So there's no. There are lots of atheists that don't believe in global warming and people that don't have an axe to grind that don't believe in it. But evolution is a different thing. And so it's only people with a religious predisposition to be skeptical of it that try to poke holes in it. So evolution is actually largely responsible for the secular bent of society. And you can see after the 19th century, the number of people that believe in God dropped sharply. Even Richard Dawkins said, when I was a young man, I looked at the universe and said, well, of course there's a God who made all this stuff. And then he read Darwin and discovered natural selection, and he said, oh, that's how it happened. I guess there isn't a God. So the design argument is one of the most intuitive arguments. And why. So you can believe in God and evolution, but if you believe in evolution, you can't. I shouldn't say if you believe in evolution. That makes it sound like it's all subjective, like the truth depends on what you believe. But if evolution is true, then you can't prove God on the basis of the design argument. The theory of evolution takes the wind out of the sails of the design argument. It makes the design argument ineffective, because the design argument says, anytime you find order, complexity, and purpose, there has to be a design in mind. What evolution says is there doesn't have to be a design in mind. It could have just all happened by chance and natural processes. And so, therefore, there doesn't have to be a God. Now, there could be a God, and God could be consistent with evolution, but you can't say, oh, but there has to be a design in mind. If you accept evolution. All right. The problem of evil. So the problem of evil, we talked about that briefly. The inconsistent triad. God is omnipotent, which means all powerful. God is good or omnibenevolent, and evil exists, or there is evil. So all three of those things can't be true. If God's all-powerful, he's able to prevent evil. If God is good, he'll want to prevent evil. Yet evil seems to exist. So either evil doesn't exist, it's an illusion, or God isn't good, and he's able to prevent evil but doesn't want to, in which case it seems he's malevolent. Or it could be that God is he wants to prevent evil, but for some reason he can't, in which case he's impotent or incompetent. So. But if God is not omnipotent, or he's not good, then he's not really not God. He doesn't fit our conception of what God is. So there's various attempts to defend against this. We looked at the book of Job about a bet between God and Satan, and that's really the main argument in Job is what I call the human ignorance theodicy, which is, well, even though we can't figure out why God allows little girls, or actually I posted a story in the optional metaphysics forum. Why does God allow 5-year-old boys to be abducted by psychos who decide they want to kill somebody to see what it would be like and think it might be a little fun, and then take this 5-year-old boy, abduct him, rape him, kill him, and eat his flesh, and stick the bones in your desk drawer. Right, so that's what this guy did. And you think, well, God could have stepped in at any moment. He could have, done a miracle, but he might have just sort of done something behind the scenes, like, just like some little tiny thing, like had a phone call come at right this the wrong moment, or God could have, caused it to start pouring down rain when he saw that this guy was going to go out looking for a child or something like that. God could have even made an anonymous phone call to the police. Right? I mean, he could have done all kinds of things, but he didn't do anything. And then the parents agonize over, where's our boy? There's a manhunt and a long search. And then this psycho tries to kill somebody his own age who's able to fight back, and that led to this person being caught finally. And now he's going to get early release. And God doesn't seem to be doing anything about that either. So he's going to be out walking the streets soon, and the father of the boy who was killed has vowed to kill the killer, and he said obviously he's not trusting God to take care of it. He's going to or the law. He's going to take matters into his own hands. But anyway, you think about that's the, and I bring up these extreme cases not because I like to sort of revel in human degradation and misery. It's that it's just really easy to deny it. People will say things like, we human beings, we think death is so bad, but we're going to go to a better place, and God's going to make everything better. And, the world is a great place. Sunset, and God sends the rain, and sometimes it gets a little cold, but by golly, variety is the spice of life. Meanwhile, like some kid in Somalia is trying to crawl away from a vulture who's like eyeing him for dinner. And, people live in this sort of bubble in America where they think that everything's sweetness in life, and they're somewhat insulated from all the varieties of human misery. Although, again, like this, this 5-year-old kid was killed in America, so, it hits you every once in a while. But some people just get lucky and they don't have bad things happen to them for until much later in life. Or, some people, they live a charmed life and nothing seems to touch them for most of their life. So anyway, that's the problem of evil. The free will defense says that it's impossible for God to create free beings who would only do good. So the idea is that being free is important. To be free means you're able to love, and you're able to, and God wants beings who are capable of love. Love is a free will choice. You can't a robot can't love you. Right? So God knew that creating free beings ran the risk of them sinning and disobeying him and causing him misery, but he did it anyway because there's a greater good to be achieved. It's not a problem for omnipotence because God can't do the logically impossible. And creating free beings who only do good, it's argued, is a logical contradiction. Because if you're free, you have the capacity to do both good and evil. Otherwise, you're not really free. So that would be like saying God could bake a cake that I baked all by myself. That was just a contradiction. So the problem with the free will defense is that violating a person's free will doesn't always seem to be a bad thing. When I gave examples of like the Good Samaritan who saves a person in distress, we think about those people as heroes. I mean, if you saved a woman from being mugged, would she say, "How dare you violate my free will and the free will of my assailant?" No, she'd say, "Oh, thank you," you know, and she would want to see that guy go to jail. The police do that all the time. They violate the free will of suspects, sometimes for, you know, growing a bunch of potted plants in their backyard. There's not that the law says they're not supposed to have, but sometimes it's for killing 5-year-old kids and eating their flesh, right? So, I mean, there's different degrees of transgression, but we violate the free will of people all the time, and we don't. And we think that what's more important to save human beings from suffering than to violate their free will. I mean, they even take people who are suicidal and put them in the psych ward and tie them down to the bed to make sure they're not a danger to themselves or others. Right? That we take people and we try to keep them from killing themselves. They're not even a danger to other people. So that shows that most people think, and society in general seems to think, that that violating a person's free will isn't the worst thing in the world, that human suffering can often be worse. Okay, and then we're coming to the meaning of life. Oh, the spiritual development theodicy. And that's just that the argument is that God has to allow us to make decisions, and we have to suffer because suffering builds character. And if we didn't ever make any mistakes, if we never had to live with the consequences of our action, we couldn't grow into the sorts of beings that God wants us to be. And the problem with that is, like, why didn't God create us the way He wanted us in the first place? If God wants beings who are wise and have good character, why didn't He make them in the first place? Why didn't God create instant saints? Because He could. Why go through all this rigmarole? God can do anything He wants by divine fiat. He says, "Let there be light," and there is light. He doesn't need to use means to create ends. If God wants to make a pot, God doesn't have to go get some clay and a potting wheel, right? God says, "Let there be a pot," and the pot, poof, the pot pops into existence. So it doesn't make any sense to think that God has to go through this rigmarole and put us through all this suffering to get us to be the way He wants us. So that's an objection. Another objection is that suffering really seems to screw people up. Like my ex-wife is a great example. She, she never knew her father, who died freebasing cocaine. She found her mother in a pool of her own blood because she was an alcoholic, but she was also had an intolerance to alcohol. And so she vomited up blood and died in the bathroom. I think my wife was about 9. And then she grew up with her religious fanatic grandmother, who always told her she was going to hell for not doing her chores or making her bed. And then there was the other aunt, that she grew up with, who was the floozy, gold-digging nightclub singer. And then there was the other aunt, who was the woman who worked for the phone company, who was afraid of men because grandpa used to beat grandma and the kids would hide in the closet. And so the one turned into a woman who was afraid of men and had no relationships, I think, at all with them. And the other one saw men as tools to be used and abused. And so, you know, you think about all those social influences, and then, you know, and what sort of attitudes would you think a person would have about, men? Those are really screwed up ones, right? So she had like a ton of psychological problems that, you know, I should have been aware of but wasn't. So you think about this idea that suffering builds character. Well, sometimes it does, but mostly it just screws people up when they have to go through years of therapy, and it poisons their relationships, and it poisons their career, and it gives them all kinds of problems. And so this idea that it's good for you, you know, maybe in measured doses, you know, like running around the track and going that extra mile and the coach yelling at you, or maybe going through boot camp for 6 weeks, maybe that's character building experience. Going to Iraq and seeing awful things that you that wake you up in the middle of the night screaming, you know, maybe not so much of a character building experience. Although some people say it is. Most people say if they're in the throes of war, it's a horrific experience they'd rather not talk about and would prefer to forget. You should know, let's see. Kind of going back to the design argument, you should know the Miller experiment. And I think I glossed over that, but it will be on the test. So the Miller experiment. The Miller experiment was done in the 1950s, and my pen is completely dead now. The Miller experiment was done in the 1950s, and it created amino acids. You can do this experiment at home. You just need a terrarium and some basic chemicals. So they took an aquarium and got like a battery and put some ammonia and some nitrogen and just different stuff that we think was in the atmosphere and zapped it with the battery. And wow, amino acids, the building blocks of proteins, the building blocks of life. So this is part of this theory. It's not just, you know, some fanciful speculation that you get clouds of gas rubbing against each other, you get a static discharge, and that's enough to get us off the races. The meaning of life, we looked at Tolstoy, and we looked at Bertrand Russell. So let's take Russell first. So Russell says religion is both good and bad. It's bad because it robs you of natural pleasures in life. You're always feeling guilty about sex and liking having nice things and making lots of money and going out and getting drunk and all the things that people enjoy doing. But it's also the best in religion is a representation of human idealism. Like the ethics of, you know, the ideals of justice and brotherly love. But those don't come from God. Those come from man who created religion. And the good parts of religion express the good sides of human beings. And in that respect, they're worthwhile. And so he says, when you're thinking about your attitude towards life, first realize that science shows you a universe that doesn't give a damn about you. But what you need to do is avoid the religion of Moloch. Avoid this idea that you need to fall on your knees to some, hoping there's a God out there to hear your pleas. And also to sort of, you know, give up and be depressed the fact that you're going to die someday. So he says you need to avoid the religion of Moloch, which is the cringing submission of a slave to a cruel and capricious universe. And so he says you should approach life with some a sense of idealism, sympathy for your fellow travelers, and courage. In contrast, Tolstoy says, you know, that kind of life is absurd, and that life really is meaningless without God. He talks about the Asian fable where a man's chased into a pit by a wild beast that we talked about, and this is the rats are eating away at the branch he's holding on to. If he holds on to the branch, he's going to go into the mouth of a dragon because the mice are going to eat through it, and that's representative of aging, eventually leading to death. If he lets go, he can go in the dragon's jaws early, or he can try to crawl out of the pit and take his chances with the wild beast that's been chasing him. But either way, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't. And so this is a metaphor for the human condition. And so what Tolstoy says is that he went through this existential crisis, and he'd done everything, been there, done that. He'd been famous. He had a family. He had a career. And finally, he was wondering, well, what else is there? He goes into the suicidal depression. And finally, he realizes that it's the peasants with their simple life of hard work and religious faith, who were the only happy people. That all his intellectual, rich friends were all, miserable, paradoxically. And so his answer was, it's the simple faith of the peasant believer. And he gives his handle analogy. And the handle analogy is this idea that you come to a new town and they tell you, just pull that handle a bunch of times and we'll give you dinner. And the intellectuals say, well, I'm not going to hold that handle till you tell me what it does. And that's analogous to these skeptics and atheists wanting proof for God. Whereas the peasant says, really, that's all I got to do? Okay, I'll do that. And then he enjoys a meal. And that's why the peasant is happy and the elitist philosophers, the intellectuals, are a miserable and pitiable lot. Yes, sir.
I just thought that maybe the person that hesitates on pulling the handle is a little smarter, because what if you're like grinding up human flesh for your meal that you're about to eat? That's when the pulling the handle is.
I suppose. So there will be 60 questions on the exam, and feel free to come by office hours if you have any questions or make an appointment with me. I enjoyed having you in the class. It's been a fun one, and good luck on the final.
When is the final?
The final opens 8 o'clock Monday. It'll be open through Thursday at 5 p.m.